Throughout there, the main points of last time when we started doing the GR. Is there any questions about that? Let me also write down because we will need it for comparison. In Yang Mills theory, how things work. So this is from the tutorial mostly. See. Yang Mills, we had omega is, let's do it on a surface, dE trace of e dA, where ei is the normal component of the stress field strength. And then we have u sigma psi, so the integral of the nether current was a trace of psi times the equations of motion plus the boundary term. Sorry, not the equations of motion, the Gauss law. It's just the is the is just a piece of the equations of motion that is contracted with the normal essentially. So this is the Gauss law. And is in electromagnetism is the divergence of E equals zero. Gauss law, and then there is the flux of E through the boundary of the surface, and we have the equation. Everything goes through smoothly when we write the flow equation, which tells us that in the absence of boundaries, so forgetting about that term, we just have that the constraint, the Gauss constraint, generates gauge transformations. So this statement is Gauss generates gauge transformations. I write this because I want to compare it with gravity. So the details are not too important. What we really care is that we set the corners to zero, for example, and then everything goes through. In fact, the same equation would go through also with that term, but then one would have the flux as well contribute. So for simplicity, let's just think about this statement that Gauss generates. OK, so we want to see if something similar is true for diffeomorphisms. So is there any questions about those pieces? So going through them quickly, we have the Lagrangian, the usual Einstein-Hilbert equations of motion. Then we have theta, whatever its shape is, it's a bit complicated. We will try to put it in a better form next week. But this is what comes out if I take the variation of this action. This is what we get. Could be written in terms of Christoffel symbols or the extrinsic curvature, depending how hard we work. And here, I just want to remind you an identity. So this epsilon bar A is just an object. It's a top minus one form on spacetime. So it's a top form on sigma. And it's such that when contracted with a tensor, it just gives the volume element on that surface times the tensor contracted with the normal. So it's a way to write this quantity even in spacetime without referring to sigma specifically, because it automatically gives you the right answer once you specialize to a given. And finally, we had concluded with the discussion of general covariance as encoded in this equation. which is that the variation of the field variation of the Lagrangian along what we call a diffeomorphism, but in field space. So we change all the field values as if a diffeomorphism was acting on them, is the same thing as acting with the diffeomorphism on the Lagrangian. And the reason this works is that because all the fields in here are dynamical. So there are not some which are left out by this field space. So our field space, our field of space of dynamical fields contains all possible fields, and so this is why this is. So if this depends on a metric and some metric field, but the metric is fixed, then this left-hand side would not act on that fixed metric, and so we would then have this. Okay, so today we're going to use this to find some consequences, and in fact, I want to start exactly from there. So we want to find the analog of this equation for a theory which is general covariant. We will see that there will be it will not be this simple. So covariant Hamiltonian flow equation or general covariant theories. So gravity is a special case, but we will not use any of these formulas. We will just work with these, basically. So let's start from computing this. So remember, if in the what I call the best case scenario, when this is zero, and also R is zero, this extra term that comes out of varying the Lagrangian along the symmetry, then everything is simple, and we are guaranteed that the Hamiltonian flow equation, so this kind of equation works. But so this is why I start from here and want to see what happens when I work with a general covariant theory. So we have this plus the opposite term. So here I'm just applying Cartan's formula, and I recognize omega. And here, this looks a bit like the neutral current, except that we have a term missing, so we add it and subtract it. So this is P of J of Xi plus E of R of Xi. And so this is the formula, the first formula we want to look at. Signs are, yes. And here I've done absolutely nothing. This is true in any theory. For any theory, this is true. In theories where things work well, both terms vanish, maybe independently, like in Yang-Mills. And so we get in this nice formula. Now we want to use general covariance to compute the second term. Why general covariance? Well, because it tells us what that lead derivative will be, and it also tells us what R is. So let's start from R, which is simpler. By definition, R is given by this type of variation. So this is exactly what gives us R of Xi by definition. And we can compute this using general covariance here. So this is general covariance that we're using. And Cartan's formula again. L is a top form, so DL is zero. There can't, it can't do anything. So we find G of I psi L, comparing we get this. Okay. So this is the first result. Then we need to find the second one.
I have a question.
Yes.
Does it not matter that we could add an exact form, et cetera?
You can keep track of that. I will not. I will say where it happened, where it's important later. So sure, this, it's all inside the D, so we could add D of something. And in the notes, in the lecture notes, I have a section where I explain exactly where these extra terms end up and what they influence. But for simplicity, I just identify terms. And OK, so, but yes, it will turn out later that is always that this boundary term is a bit ambiguous. So, but okay. So now we do the second term. And here again, we can use general covariance to write this just as the lead derivative, the normal lead derivative of theta. And this is always the case, right? Because that also is kind of a tensorial, it's just a tensorial expression. So it's also true at this level, this kind of equality. And then again, I apply Artin's formula. And this is id theta plus d xi theta. In fact, here, I'm sorry, I forgot to finish this computation because what I need is the variation of R. So I'll finish it here. So I get the variation of the Lagrangian. And these we know, well, we use just the equation. Since we probably want to do something with this theta, we want theta to pop out from here. So we write these as the equations of motion plus d theta. Therefore, putting things together, theta minus dr of psi, it gives us these two terms cancels, so we get a boundary term, a corner term actually, minus. Okay, so let's look. They are both top minus one forms on spacetime, just as they should, except that this is exact and this is not. So let me plug them back in that equation. And then see, and then go from there before discussing things. Plus of I E plus D xi theta. And now we integrate. Let's suppose we have a situation like this. So our sigma has some boundary, so that we can keep track of this term. And we integrate this equation over sigma. So integrating over sigma, we find, sigma equal to dq from here minus is over sigma plus a term on the boundary of sigma. So by the way, you see if you add a d exact term here, I suspect you would be you would be modifying this term. But if you So, and whatever you do here, you also have to do to the Noether current. So it's a bit complicated. Things can reshuffle in a bit in a non-trivial way. So that's why I'm not tracing back the ambiguities, because they pop out at different places, and it's a bit a nightmare at the blackboard. Okay, so now we get this equation, and I want to spend a few minutes discussing what it means. But is it clear how we derived it? And how this is just a consequence of general covariance? Because up there we didn't do anything, is completely theory independent. Any whatever Lagrangian symmetry we have, we can write that down. And here is where things happened. We rewrote that last term by using general covariance to change the field space variation to space-time ones and repackage terms. Okay, so this equation contains a ton of information. So usually what we would say is that supposing that these terms are not there, we would have that the Noether charge is the generator of gauge transformation. But what is happening here? We have two obstructions to this statement, and we want to understand the origin of each. So these are obstruction to the naive statement that Noether charge generates gauge transformation. So we have obstruction one, which we see it's a bulk obstruction. And then we have two, which is it's a boundary, but boundary of sigma. So here is bulk of sigma. We are working over here. So bulk and boundary refers to the slice. So let's see each of them, what each of them means. So the first one, we already see that it is proportional to the equations of motion. So it goes away when we go on shell. So we will say much more about this next week. But now let me just point out the following. So one, it's an issue off shell. So off shell of what? Of the constraint, because in fact, we will find out that term is precisely proportional to the constraint. Of constraint associated to, and here is the important point. So which part of Xi enters that equation? I claim it here and I prove it below to normal to diffeos transverse to sigma. So the problem here are not all diffeos, but just those transverse. Most diffeos, those tangent to sigma, will actually give a zero contribution to that term. Why? Because of that recall equation up there. So let me write it. Indeed, the integral over sigma of I xi e, let me write it explicitly. So this is, you see, the equations of motion are always a top form. So they're always proportional to epsilon. So what this is actually of this form. So here we have E, A, B, whatever that is, delta G, A, B. Here I'm just saying I put emphasis on what the form part is and the rest. I can always do that. So here I have the rest. And the form part, I'm contracting Xi with epsilon, which just gives me this by definition. And if I work this out, this is precisely as I wrote up there, psi A and A is proportional to this. So it's only the normal part of psi that matters. Let me do this in coordinates so that it becomes clear. So suppose sigma is the surface x0 equal some value t. Epsilon is equal to square root of g dx0 wedge, well, dx1 up to the top one over spacetime, right? Well, let's say the spacetime is d plus one dimensional, so let's call that d. Now, if I contract psi with epsilon, what happens? This will be psi 0 times that plus psi 1 times the other ones. So roughly speaking, this will be the sum over psi A dx 0 wedge dxa. I put a hat to say that this one is not there. Dxd, right? Is it? There are signs, but plus or minus. But the point is, they all disappear except one. They all stay except one, which is the one that coincides with that index. And now, if we want to pull back this form on this sigma, we see that pull back to sigma, what happens is that dx0 vanishes identically on sigma, right? So all these terms vanish except the one that contains the, where the one containing psi 0. And therefore, the only surviving term is the one proportional to psi 0 times dx1. So you see, it's only the transverse part of psi that matters in this equation. In coordinates, it's easy to see, because those parallel essentially are killed by the fact that you're pulling back on that surface. This is proof in coordinates of that fact. So here, of course, the thing I hadn't said is that this is delta A0, basically, in this coordinate. So this is just psi contracted with n. OK. So we will see next week that normal diffeomorphisms transverse to the surface will have a very special status, and they will not be treatable as gauge symmetries in the Young-Mills sense. Like, they are more complicated. Whereas if you're tangent to the surface, they just work as gauge transformations in Young-Mills. So we start seeing where gravity is complicated. It's about the fact that the surface, so what are these diffeos transverse to my surface? They're those that are evolving it in spacetime, right? So they're not, they're about dynamics in sense. And we see that this is what is causing the issue. Whereas these other ones that move the surface around, okay, you can deal with them at a fixed time. And so those are like gauge. You can expect that if everything goes well and enough, those are fine. But those that push my surface up and down, then yeah, those are those that give me issues. Then, but this is what we will analyze in great details next week. So second term, the boundary one. So how can we understand this? So if I have a situation like this one, where I have a surface in spacetime with a boundary, what is, let's step back from this, oops, sorry. Let's step back from this problem, this specific problem, and think about the dynamics. What can I hope to be? So I have the equations of motion for my field theory, and I have the data on the sigma. What's the domain, the space-time region in which I can use the data, the initial data on sigma to predict the evolution of the fields? It cannot be everywhere. It's going just to be the domain of dependence of the sigma, what is called the domain of dependence. So since the equations are relativistic, whatever happens outside will propagate at the speed of light towards the inside. So, and vice versa in the past. So I find one of these, they're called diamonds sometimes. It's a this is like a light cone shining towards the past, this one shining towards the future, which intersect at partial sigma. Of course, in reality, it can be more complicated, but this is the basic idea. And so inside this double cone, the data, the initial data on sigma are completely sufficient to predict the evolution of the fields inside there, but not outside. Now, for a similar reasoning as before, what component of psi intervene in that term? So here we said that it's just the psi transverse to sigma. Same thing here, it's just the psi transverse to the boundary that intervene. So this is non-zero. If and only if, well, no, if and only if maybe is a bit too strong, but it can be non-zero only if psi is transverse to the boundary. It's the same reasoning as before. There's nothing new. I just look at the form, I look where it contracts, and I just check. It must be in the normal directions, otherwise it would. So you see what is happening here. If I move my boundary around, I'm changing this cone, this double cone structure, this domain. So whereas if I reshuffle things inside, even if suppose I'm on shell, I can even push the surface up and down, it would be okay because the second term would vanish. But there's nothing I can do about the last term, even on shell. And this is because I'm moving my, I'm actually changing my causal domain if I change the position of my corner. So I'm not talking about the same physical system anymore. If I push, if I'm allowed to push my boundary around.
So there the argument is, means you're saying that the same argument will hold here also?
It's just about the forms, so the same contractions. So here xi, that is that must be transverse to sigma, which survives, and here is xi is transverse to partial. There are two of them. Those normal in the time direction and those normal in the space direction. But is the same algebra of these four.
So in this, yeah, because here the theta would be proportional to the top form but on sigma.
Exactly. Is the top form on sigma that matters?
Is there any conceptual difference apart from the dimensional?
Well, yes. The dimensional argument is about, so I'm making two points. There is one mathematical point that says that this is not zero if psi is transverse. This is just a fact. It's not. It allows us to identify which diffeomorphisms we are worrying about. Then we have to give a physical explanation for it. So there I said, if we are off shell, so E does not vanish, normal diffeos, which are about dynamics, give us problems. Fine. We can. It makes sense. And we will worry about them next week. Now, even if we go on shell, and those are somehow taken care of, we realize that this term is actually important there. It doesn't go away going on shell. And the reason something funky is happening is because I'm actually, if I allow myself to change where this boundary sits, I'm actually talking about different physical systems. So this is a bit heuristic, but it's a way to think about what's the origin of that second term. And this reason why I say it's a different physical system is because if I know my initial data here, I can predict them all over elsewhere in this double cone region. And so, for example, if I deform my sigma up and down like this, so this is the original one, I can deform it like this, would stay within the same diamond. The equations of motion allow me to predict from the initial data here, what's happening up there. So there shouldn't be any, if you're thinking about phase space and so on, this should be the same phase. It's about statement in the same phase space. Whereas here, if I allow myself to change, to shift the region left and right, then I'm really changing the causal reason, the region. And then I'm saying this would be a totally different phase space. It's not even in the same.
What if we change along the cone? It's also changed, right?
Because but if I just push it here, then I would cut out a piece of the. But that's an interesting question because here, asymptotically null infinity has this form, and so moving things up and down there is actually what people study a lot. So there's a lot of study about null surfaces and what happens when you move along these.
I didn't understand why cone is important here. Like if I consider cylinder,
It's
still the same argument.
So suppose let's draw both. So suppose there is an experimenter here. And she does something, and then whatever she does, it will propagate within her future null cone. So, but if she's outside of this domain, of this double cone domain, it cannot enter it because things can at best move along this null direction. But what happens if she does it here? Well, at some point, they will enter. So this cylindrical domain is very different than this domain. So here, I cannot predict the future indefinitely up the cylinder. In fact, not even an epsilon away, because I have no clue what is happening here. Whereas inside here, a priori, that's... I mean, inside here, I can. There are. It depends on the details of the differential equations, but that's the best I can hope. And you see, this makes sense in relativistic field theory. In a non-relativistic field theory, there's action at the distance, and so this thing doesn't make sense. You're always in this situation. So this is something really about.
In terms of this argument that you said, if I change the boundary because the shape of light cone changed, I shouldn't expect that quantity.
So what I'm saying is that if I have a phase space defined on this sigma, I will have the same phase space defined on this other surface. Now,
but still the argument holds. Like, let's.
No, wait. So, but if instead of going up here, because I'm looking at the diffeomorphism like this, I take a diffeomorphism that does not vanish at the boundary, or is not parallel to the boundary, then the new surface I'm looking at will have a different domain of dependence. Mm-hmm. And so it's a different phase space altogether.
This is one side, but in other side, like imagine the top part of cone. I change the matrix very small.
Here, like this? But I'm not.
It doesn't change anything.
I'm saying, yeah, fine. No. What I'm saying is the cone, I'm not, is completely, I fix sigma, and this has its own double cone structure. It's a structure associated to sigma. It's not that I'm prescribed, like, this is given once you give me sigma. It's not that you can deform it. It's just a property of sigma in that spacetime is this causal. Of course, it's heuristic because everything depends on the metric. The metric is dynamical, but I think it's a good picture to have in mind to see that why the transverse diffeomorphisms create troubles, because they're actually changing the phase space I'm talking about. Okay, now that we have both, let me say a caveat to this reasoning. If I have strong enough boundary conditions, for example, even on those, I could say, oh, I put so strong boundary conditions that forbid any radiation to come in. They're just telling me there's no radiation that comes in. Or maybe they are reflecting boundary conditions. So then I can predict what is happening in that domain again. So in presence of strong enough boundary conditions, I might be able to deal with that boundary term, the corner term over here, number two. So the caveat is, if I have strong enough boundary condition, I might be able to reabsorb two into my charge, for example. And we will see an example in a black hole spacetime where asymptotic infinity is actually, you're saying that is flat. And so there is enough structure to deal with that piece. So caveat. If strong enough boundary conditions. But this has to be checked case by case, of course, are imposed. It might be that xi theta at the corner is actually of the form d of something. And if this is the case, then I can reabsorb it in Q. But this doesn't happen in general. I need to check it in a specific case. Okay, so let's now go back to GR. And look at what the Noether current actually is. Is there any further question about this? I hope that this at least gives you a taste why diffeomorphisms are more complicated than other gauge transformations, because they're actually moving around the surfaces. So all the things that were happening in internal space for free, now they are tied to notions of dynamics, of the definition of the subsystems. And this is what is creating trouble.
So if I took sigma big enough, though, so that this corner term is like at infinity mm-hmm. or whatever, then do we still get the same issue? Can you have a diffeomorphism that moves infinity around? Or
so The reason why asymptotic infinity is so useful is because it's actually imposing this kind some strong boundary conditions. It's a way to impose these constructions of asymptotic infinity are a way to so for example, let me by analogy, let's consider electromagnetism, where I say, oh, I'm doing all these computations of diffraction and whatnot in the radiation zone. What do I mean is that I'm far away from the charges and I can just look at the 1 over r or r squared terms, depending on what I'm doing. Now, being far away from the charges is a very well-defined statement in once you have a background and your field's moving that back. But it's very hard to make such general statements in a general covariant way. So what asymptotic infinity does, and in a different invariant way. So what the construction of asymptotic infinity does is to give you a prescription to build a field space of fields with certain boundary conditions that have certain properties at infinity in a nicely controlled way. And then within that class of metrics, you have extra properties. And in particular, you might gain some notions of energy thanks to these tricks and things like that. So to come back to that question, usually what one is mostly interested in is to look at what happens by shifting up and down along infinity, more than pushing infinity inside. However, I'm no expert, but in ADS-CFT, your theory is, technically speaking, not defined at infinity, it's defined an epsilon inside. And then people do wonder what happens if you change that epsilon, how you define that epsilon. And in fact, pushing the surface inside should be, in some sense, telling you how you are, what's the quantum space-time inside your holographic space. So here I'm talking about things I do not really understand, but so I believe that once you start asking those questions, these problems are relevant. And so I know of some, yeah. There was a former PSI student who actually has worked on applications of what we will see next week. But instead for the time evolution in this direction of a hypersurface, the radial one in ADS. Exactly to answer these sort of questions about. So there is, yeah, it's related to holographic renormalizations and things like that. I cannot say more without saying wrong. Don't push me, please. Anything else? Okay. So let's see now at the GR Noether current and these. So this is defined just like this. And so I have all the ingredients. I can just plug them in. Now, remember, let me write. I will not do the actual computation, but I will give you, I will show you how it works. It is actually not too long. So this theta is of the form. So let's look at the first term. You see, it looks like a divergence of something. And then that something is delta of the metric. But now delta of the metric under a diffeomorphism. So we will see in a second what it is. And here we have R, which is the Lagrangian. So this is 1 half R minus lambda psi A epsilon A. So now, so what is this guy? This guy is itself some covariant derivative of psi with the indices lowered, actually. So this is ABC contracted in some ways, minus 1 half r minus lambda a epsilon a. Now, you can imagine that if I reshuffle these terms and commute one covariant derivative across the other, I find some curvature up here. So this will give me RAB, CB, well, maybe I put the indices up because it's a bit nicer, minus 1 half R plus lambda I wanted to finish what I had in here. So I have a term like this, and the other term is like this, let's say, minus this term over here. I'm just copy pasting. So it turns out that this combined with that gives me the equations of motion, which is what we expect because the bulk part of the neutral current vanishes on shell. So it should be proportional to the equations of motion. And then we have a total divergence here. So now I will write it properly. But it's just to give you an idea of how the two terms mix to give the equations of motion. So I have RAB minus RGAB and lambda GAB. So that's how the two terms come together. And the final result is. And the calculation is written in the notes. So just because I have it 1 half over there, here there is a 2. But AB CB plus 1 half C DC psi A minus DA. I see. So in the end, it's really not too bad. This is a simple formula. So this looks like there's no plus, so it's not a lead derivative. There's a minus, so this is very important. If it was a plus, it would be the lead derivative of G along psi, but it's not. It's a minus. So it looks like, in fact, a two form. So I could write this. So if I, this term, so this is C, what I had otherwise written C alpha xi alpha other times. So it's the constraint which vanishes on shell. Well, the constraint is the normal contraction of this, so the normal part of the equations of motion. And here, what I have is D of J psi, so it's a total divergence, so it's an exact form. And is current J is given by this term. So J psi equal to, now I'm a bit in trouble with the 1 half, I think it's 1 fourth of EC psi A minus DA psi C epsilon AB now because it's a two form. Well, a top minus two form. So there are two indices here. ACA. And there is a quarter because I believe there is this 1 half and the 1 half due to this contraction. Now, another way of writing this, which you might see in certain papers, you can define the form, let's call it G of psi, which is GAB psi A big CB. So for every vector, if I have a metric, I can define an associated one form. And this is up to a prefactor, which I'm not trying to get right. This is D of G psi. This is just G psi. What am I saying? No. There is a star. So a star, I have it written here instead of trying to remember. at the blackboard. Yeah, here it is. So it's equal to my 1/2 star d of g xi. So this could be, it's just another way of writing it. So this is is to emphasize that there is a minus here, which is reflected by it. But anyway, various ways of writing this aside, this is called the Komar current. So the Komar. Sometimes it's called a superpotential because it's not quite the current. It's something that once derived gives you a current. So let's call it superpotential. And its integral on the corner is called the Komar charge. So these expressions were written in the 50s by Komar. That's why they. Okay, we have a few more minutes. So let me introduce. So we have now really all the ingredients we need for the. Yeah.
Hey, could you just maybe move the left point down again? Just because I was.
The top one? Yeah. Oh, because the light weren't. Good. So the network current, to summarize, of general relativity has a bulk piece that vanishes, as always, for a local symmetry, which is given exactly by the equations of motion, contracted with my diffeomorphism, plus the total divergence, the divergence of a superpotential, which is the Komar superpotential, which gives me, once integrated on one of these corners, gives me the Komar charge. So if I integrate this codimension 2 top minus 2 form on a top minus 2 codimension 2 surface, I get a number, and this is the Komar charge. So, and you see that Q is just given by this because the on shell, the bulk part doesn't contribute. So, Q sigma on shell is just equal to the Komar charge. And again, these are in general ambiguous because of the corner ambiguities that I have not kept track of, but one has to be mindful that one needs something to justify why this is the right quantity, and if not, which other quantities one is looking. So the goal of tomorrow is to go through Wald's proof that the first law of black hole mechanics can be read out of the Hamiltonian flow equation over there, the one that I just basically, this one here. So I want to just set up the stage for this in the last 5 minutes, saying what the ideas are so that tomorrow we can start computing. I forgot the year, but early 90s. Okay, so the equations that we have, I write it here because for reference, is the one I wrote up there, and we will consider it on shell. So let me throw away this term here. This term is interesting if I'm trying to do a phase space construction, but here we're just looking at solutions of the Einstein's equation, so that term is not so interesting. And now we have this term. So we want to show that this equation, from these, we can deduce the famous formula and here I have an issue. So from J is the angular momentum now. So that's, I have just so many letters I can use. So I will try to work with Q as much as I can instead of J, and hopefully it will not create too much confusion. But this is the angular momentum of the black hole. This is the energy of my. So the idea is that I have a black hole spacetime, I perturb it, and then quantities are related like this. And this is the first law of black hole mechanics. And in fact, here I wrote S, but in fact, what comes out of geometric computation cannot be an entropy. This is an interpretation with the error. This is, but partly, we will, and the temperature will not be, of course, the temperature is the surface gravity. I will, partly what happens that such an equation just is one of those that justify the interpretation of the area as the entropy and the surface gravity as the temperature. And we will also discuss the zero law, which says that the surface gravity is constant in equilibrium, in a sense. And so it's also a typical properties that temperatures have. So why this is plausible, I'm not proving it here, but I'm just giving the idea, is that let's say that my diffeomorphism is, so energy is related to, is the generator usually of time translation and angular momentum of rotation. So if I take my diffeomorphism to be a time translation, well, I can actually, plus an angular, so this is a time diffeomorphism, which translates times. This is an angular diffeomorphism. This is some property associated to the black hole spacetime, which is the angular velocity of the spacetime. Then if I plug this in here, it's not completely unrealistic that the charge somehow we know about my energy and my angular momentum. E and J. Now, what about this guy? So, as I said, the whole point is that this is the area and the temperature is the surface gravity, which are quantities I will define. The point is that sigma has two boundaries. So one at infinity, and so this is these computations come from the part of the boundary of sigma that is at infinity, and the part of sigma that touches the horizon will give me will give me the area. So this is ds at the horizon. So this is how the various pieces come about. And this term will not be there, will be zero. And the reason is that this guy is a killing vector field. And so this guy vanishes and the left-hand side completely. So that's why I wrote it like this, zero equal, because the left-hand side of this equation. So this is the broad idea. Next time we will see how all the ingredients actually fit in the picture. And you see, I just want to say one small thing here. Even though this might be true, if I take delta, for example, I would find, you see, there's something weird going on. The t is outside the delta. Omega is outside the delta. So we will worry about this issue, why they're not inside. Because a priori, if psi is written like this, things should actually hit my variation. So we will be careful about this subtle issue, which is very important for the first law, of course. It's not delta of something. It's t delta s and omega delta. Okay.